Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who were these guys?
Pedal to the metal, Junkions. It's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com.
Eastbound and also down. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury.
Eastbound and really down.
I mean, real down. Loaded up and also trucking. With my friend and co-host, novelist, screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce.
He's always loaded.
Always loaded, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
This is exciting. I'm really excited for this episode.
This is the second time this year that I have said we need to cover this movie for a long time. And you're like, yeah, we should do that. And then you sat down to watch the movie and it melted your brain and you said, holy fuck, this movie. And then we get to have an exciting episode of Cargill Was Right.
which I know you hate so much.
This is the second time this year that I have turned you on to a movie that you have so fell in love. Like, I've turned you on to a couple things this year that you didn't know existed. Things like Thank God It's Friday and things like that, which are fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And were good movies. But this is fucking Hooper. And this is a movie that you're going to carry with you now.
Absolutely. And speaking of carrying things with you, if you carry a phone device in your pocket, you can download our entire back catalog.
Do you guys not have phones?
Do you not have phones? By the way,
I don't know. Are you in on that meme by any chance?
I don't know about that, but just I know it's really early for this, but a quick sidebar. I have figured out that gets mad when people call a VCR a VHS player years old. Because it really fucking bugs me when people say a VHS player instead of a VCR.
Okay, well, I'm going to be annoyed at the fact that those are actually two different things.
But they're not. Okay, we can split those hairs.
But that's there are VHS players that cannot record. And there are VCRs, which are recorders.
But that's not what people are referring to. They're just calling it a VHS player because of the current lexicon of a DVD and Blu-ray player.
That may be true. There was somebody this week, though, on Reddit who had showed a picture of an old 1987 mint condition VHS player TV combo, and it had a side-mounted VHS player.
Side mount,
which I've never seen a side mount on those things. They're always top or bottom mount, usually bottom mount.
I mean, if there's one guy that knows about being a bottom mount, it's C. Robert Cargill. Rim shot!
Yeah. Rim job. no, but this was actually like, and in fact, it was cool because it actually said which side to put the label. Like, it's label that way. But there was no record. There was play, there was stop, rewind, fast forward. You could not record on that thing. It was a VHS player.
In my life, I have never seen a VCR or I've never seen a player of VHS that didn't have a record function, including the VHS TV combo that I had for a while still had a record function, so this is completely foreign.
The whole point of them initially, why they sold them, how they sold them for those. You know what? Let's just do this. Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill. The whole point of getting a VCR in the early 80s had nothing to do with renting videos. Renting videos was a side thing you could do. It was like, oh, now I could rent the occasional movie that I want to see. The whole point of it was to record television episodes specifically for nights where you had dueling must-see television. Because for those of you that don't quite realize, in 1980, on Friday night, when you wanted to watch The Incredible Hulk and The Dukes of Hazzard on CBS, that meant you were missing whatever else was on that night. That was followed by Dallas. So, you know, you had this Friday night that was like, oh my God. But if you liked another show, you just didn't get to see that show.
Right.
Done. End of story. Sorry, dude.
You had to make a Sophie's Choice, including if Dallas was playing up against Sophie's Choice on another channel.
VCRs had developed the technology in the early 80s that it could record on another channel while you were watching another channel. And that was space age fucking technology.
It's Baba Yaga.
It was, yes, it was just like, holy fuck, you mean I can watch my show? And then when my show's over, I could watch the show that was playing on another channel. Oh my God, this is a game changer. And then once you had that technology, it was like, hey, you could also go to this family-owned mom-and-pop video store around the corner and rent the same 12 movies that every video store had. And then that, of course, grew out. And as I've talked about in the past, I used to go to Circle K to rent my movies. They had a selection of 50 movies. They were all junky as fuck.
Something was always afoot at the Circle K.
Something was afoot at the Circle K. Something was always a hand. That's where I discovered Band of the Hand.
Not where I thought that story prompt was going, but okay.
That's, you know, that's where I discovered Creepers. It's where I discovered Tracks. The same store God I rented damn. All three of those movies from. The same Circle K on the corner. And then, of course, Blockbuster showed up and promised 8,000 titles. And we were like, holy fuck, 8,000. And they're like, did we say 8? We meant 10. And it's like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And then, you know, we entered the age of the video store. But initially, VCRs were entirely about recording shit that was on television, and being able to watch other movies was superfluous. It also meant those of us, you know, those of us rich kids whose parents paid $12 a month to have HBO could record our favorite movies and watch some of our favorite movies. You didn't buy movies. They put out Star Wars on VHS. Do you know how much Star Wars cost in 1983? $96.
Shut the fuck up.
That's
seriously?
$1983. It was $96. you no kid had when I was the age to came out on VHS, I thought $100 meant you were rich.
Right.
And what would I buy with $100? I'd buy this, and I'd buy a whole bunch of G.I. Joes, and I'd buy this and this. Like, no, I would buy one cassette of Star Wars.
Man. That is that. What you've just done, I want to point this out to you, is told everybody the origin of this show is this Circle K. So if anyone has their leftover Time Cop machine, they're going to go back and burn that thing down if they hate this podcast.
By the way, true story, I almost told a similar story last episode. I talked about being in Tucson earlier this year for the Tucson Festival of Books. When I got into the car, the woman who was my connection with the festival, she was my driver for the whole weekend. And she was like, hey, you know, first time to Tucson? I'm like, no, actually, I lived here for 4 years when I was a kid. And we talked about it. And she goes, you want to drive around and see anything? And I was like, yes, I do. And there were three things I wanted to see. I want to drive by the Air Force Base that I grew up on. I wanted to drive down to the comic store that I bought all my comics from when I wasn't buying from, you know, the BX or the Circle K. And I wanted to drive by the Circle K, because that Circle K, as much as it's just a fucking corner store, was the corner store where I not only bought comics, but rented my videos and rented a lot of the junky stuff that the base video store didn't have. And it hasn't fucking changed. 30 years later, fucking thing is still there, still looks the fucking same. It was unreal. But yeah, that, by the way, yeah. If you want to go back in time and distort the time stream and fuck me up for good, the Circle K that is on the corner right there in front of Davis Monthan Air Force Base, that's the one that you fuck up.
Shit, we may have to jump in the machine and go back and thwart people from doing that now. Go dust off the Time Cop machine. We're going to need it.
Hey, we're talking about a movie this week.
Hey, by the way, at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter, we got so into the sidebar so fast, I didn't even finish the business up top. So at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like this show,
I mean, you really like what just happened.
If you love things that are off the rails, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to content that no one else gets to hear because we have erased it from the files of history.
How far are we into this episode, I'm curious?
12 minutes.
Okay, so I'm glad we got really nostalgic early on.
Yes.
Because for sure, this is going to be a very nostalgic episode. This is a centerpiece of Junk Food Cinema Americana, if you will.
And not only that, but I feel like if we did have a time machine, the first thing I would do is go back to when we were doing Summer of 78, and we had put this film on the docket.
I put this film at the top of the list.
You put it on there, and the only reason we didn't cover it is because we got behind leading up to the recording and found out that it was streaming nowhere. We'd have to order it. We didn't know if it'd be here on time. So we just skipped Hooper.
Burt Reynolds is Hooper.
And then we got to Octobert.
And
Hooper was on the list again.
Yeah, and similar situation happened. We just got behind, didn't find enough.
And nobody's
time to order
fucking streaming it. Yeah. Now, welcome to Decembert.
Nice.
There's a reason we have to talk about this movie. In fact, there are six reasons we have to talk about this movie. There is so much of this movie that is important to who we are as a podcast.
And Hooper is a real hero.
To understanding Burt Reynolds, to understanding Hal Needham. To understanding why a certain woman is still one of the most beautiful women ever to exist on the planet. Oh, Jesus Christ is right.
So is. Like, oh. Yeah. If you didn't know it before this movie will remind you for sure.
He can take more crashes.
Oh, Jesus!
More fire.
Ah! Hello, gorgeous.
More love. More hits. He can take more risks and have more fun than anyone can imagine. This is Hooper, the story of the greatest stuntman of them all and his competition. He really means action. Hooper's in a dangerous business, but his reward is excitement, adventure, and a fortune if he lives to collect it. Burt Reynolds is Hooper, the greatest stuntman alive.
I love stuntmen.
Hooper, the newest movie from the team that brought you Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah, so Hooper is, you know, we've talked on the show a lot about a guy who I'm going to say it right now. I feel needs to be another of our, if not a patron saint, at least on Mount Junkmore.
He's got to be on Mount Junkmore. I did an entire, when Harry Knowles was doing his Ain't It Cool TV show, he had me on a couple of times. And we did an episode together after, it was right after Hal Needham died. And he was like, well, shit, I'm having Cargill on. And Cargill's a huge Hal Needham fan. We've got to do a Hal Needham episode. And so there's actually a Hal Needham episode in which me and Harry sit around and talk about the history of Hal Needham while putting together a mint condition right out of the box Hal Needham action stuntman playset from the 1970s, in which it was a Western bar and you had a Hal Needham action figure and it showed you how the stunts worked. And you had all these stuntmen figures and you would set up a bar brawl stunt scene and you would do the stunts. And then in that episode, Harry followed me up by interviewing Burt Reynolds about Hal Needham. So if it, yes. So like, oh, hey, I appear in an episode of television with Burt fucking Reynolds because God damn it. God bless.
Wow.
And the thing is, and the whole thing was about Hal, because Hal is one of the two greatest stuntmen in history. There was one guy who is, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden, but he's a Russian guy who did early Hollywood stuff and invented a bunch of stuff. And Hal Needham was the young Turk that took over for him. And then Hal Needham went on to become the greatest stunt, not just the greatest stuntman in history, the greatest stunt coordinator in history. Mm-hmm. He designed so many of the gags that we do today. He was a safety conscious guy. He's the opposite of George Miller. He was like, how do we do this and make sure the guy survives? Because he was king of the stuntmen. And so he sat down to make a movie with his best friend, Burt Reynolds. And I think at this point, he was living in Burt's pool house.
Now, it should be noted that both Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds were stuntmen. Burt Reynolds, at the early part of his career, was, in fact, a stuntman.
Very early.
Yeah.
And then it was discovered that he could act and he was a good-looking guy and moved out of it. And then his original stuntman, his stunt guy, was Hal Needham. And Hal Needham then moved up to stunt coordinator, and he and Hal became best friends, hanging out, drinking beers, being men. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you want to talk about alpha males of alpha males, these were the fucking guys. But the thing is that as everybody would say, they were the really nice alpha males. They were the guys who, they walked in the room, they didn't have to prove anything. they were already badasses. But then they would go, and when they were around each other, they would be outdoing each other and they'd be doing stuff. And so they made a movie about it, and they made a love letter to stuntmen. And Hal Needham directed a film starring his best friend about himself and about the life and about how fucked up the life is and about the realities of it and about the glories of it.
Yeah.
And this film is just a slice of life of what it was like to be a stuntman in the 70s while being super meta at the same time. First of all, there's something I've been dying to mention since I rewatched this last night.
What's that?
And I can't wait to see the look on your face when I mention it. Robert Klein, stand-up comedian, playing the director in this movie. I swear to God, he built a time machine and went back in time and coached himself on how to do an impression
of Oliver Stone?
No.
Oh.
Wes Anderson. Robert Klein is doing a note perfect Wes fucking Anderson in this movie 15 years before Wes Anderson would make a movie, right down to the sweater tied around his neck, right down to the flippant way he talks about things, the detachment, the snottiness.
Sure.
Like everything about Robert Klein in this movie is Wes fucking Anderson. If Wes fucking Anderson were Michael fucking Bay, like it is the weirdest fucking on the nose thing.
Further interesting because that character is based on Peter Bogdanovich.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like it's a weird amalgam of different things.
But it's
obviously not Wes Anderson. There's wasn't alive.
There's Bogdanovich there, and you see the Bogdanovich satire there, but it's so on the nose Wes Anderson.
Which is funny because I was swearing up and down he looked like Oliver Stone.
He does, and Robert Klein always has. For those of you that don't know Robert Klein was a great stand-up comedian of the 80s and 90s. He, you know, got into political comedy in the early 90s. In fact, there's a great appearance of him in one of my favorite junky romantic comedies that nobody knows exists called Definitely Maybe with Ryan Reynolds, in which Robert Klein is actually headlining an event for Clinton. And you see Robert Klein on stage, like doing the bit, one of the bits that he was doing in the 90s. I can't feel my legs. And
yeah, it sounds great.
Dude, he's a very funny comedian, and so seeing him in this movie is great, but I know he's doing Bogdanovich, but he's really fucking doing Wes. Like, next time you watch this, because I know you're going to, because you bought it,
yeah.
And the first thing you did when you walked in my office was you picked that up and you put it in your bag.
Yeah, because I don't want to forget it, because I've been keeping a running tally the last couple of years, because it really does fascinate me when
I'm right.
Yes, when you're right, it fascinates me. It happened. It's like the Halley's Comet. No,
every 76 years,
old man Cargill, indeed. No, it. I keep a running tally of all of the movies that I watch for the first time, and then I make a list of my favorite film discoveries of the year. And Hooper moved way the fuck up. I think I have it at number two right now, behind only Hardcore, Paul Schrader's Hardcore.
Really? You liked it more than you liked Ladies and Gentlemen, Fabulous Stains?
Yes, and I also liked it more than I liked Shakedown. I liked it more than I liked... I actually just saw Deep Cover for the first time.
Oh my God.
Bill Duke's Deep Cover is fucking rad. So it's on a like really great
list. By the way... Take a big old drink for that. I didn't realize you hadn't seen it, and I didn't realize you just discovered it. We're definitely talking Deep Cover.
I fucking love Deep Cover.
In fact, I'll bet we could probably get Bill Duke to talk to us about.
Don't tease me. I would lose my shit if I got to talk to Bill Duke.
I'm just saying, Bill Duke is very, very friendly on Twitter and loves talking to people. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility we might do a quick 5-minute thing with Bill Duke to talk about Deep Cover.
But yeah, so this Hooper is way the hell up on my list. And the reason for that is because there is something so beautifully meta about this movie, because it's not just, hey, I'm Hal Needham and I'm telling stories from my life and look how cool I am. It is a love letter to the craft of stunt work. And it is the most polite takedown of the studio system and how it looks at stunt people.
And a giant fuck you to assistant directors.
Yes, a giant fuck you. By the fucking way. If I had seen this movie earlier in my life, there is so much about it that is so effortlessly cool.
Yeah.
Very much a, it feels like actually a William Goldman script, which we just lost, unfortunately, because there's so many bits of dialogue that I'm like, that is just cool. That breezes by like I'm watching, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or I'm watching The Sting, or, you know, it's just like, it flows so well, and you love every second that you get to spend with these people, that if I had seen this movie sooner, so much of this movie would have worked its way into my language, my referential cinema language. One of them revolving around that character, who another character refers to as a popcorn fart.
Yeah. By the way,
popcorn fart.
The first assistant director is amongst the most hated person on set by design. The job of a first assistant director is to do all of the asshole-ish things that the director can't do so that he can keep working with everybody and keep running the ship.
And look out for those rubber bands, because we are, in fact, inside baseball.
We right are now. Like it is. And the thing is I have loved every first director I've worked with, like the first assistant director.
But you're saying as a rule, they have to be.
Okay. They are the jerks. That is their job.
By design. Okay.
By design. Like they are the assholes. They are the ones that yell through the megaphone. They're the ones that will go and shoo people out.
So that the director can maintain a good working relationship with
exactly. The and that is the whole point of what the first assistant director does. It's why it's called the assistant director. And then now there's technically four different. There's the first assistant director. There's the first second, you know, there's the second second. Like it's there's in fact, on certain huge things, you get to third assistant and second third assistant.
I'm pretty sure Infinity War has 12 assistant directors.
I don't know. Marvel usually, if I remember correctly, we stopped at second. They run a super, super type ship. But yeah, no, our first assistant director was also the first assistant director on Spectre. In fact, dies in Spectre. It was really weird watching Spectre the first time and then seeing my AD die.
Wow. Was he AD decapitated?
Their job is to be the guy who, and that's what I find so, what's so great about this movie is it is filled with truth. It is not an assassination as much as it is, this is actually how the system works. And we see that as the director says, hey, I'm going to need you to do this for me and do the dick work. And the first AD does it. But this first AD happens to be a sycophant, a suck up, a yes man in the worst way. Like there's that great scene where he's like, where Robert Klein is saying, well, we've got to shoot it this way. He's like, there's no other way to shoot it. He's like, well, actually, that's where you're wrong. There's six other ways to shoot it, but this is the best. Yeah. This is the right one. And it's like, holy fuck, I know that director and I know that AD and I hate them both. It is so very real where that little shit, that's his job, is to be the little shit on set. But he's, you know, the first AD is also supposed to be the scariest person on set.
Yeah.
He's often the one, he or she is often the one that will go and fire you. If the director says, I want that person fired, it's the first AD who's going to go and do it, or is going to designate someone to go and do it. But they're the people who do the yelling, so the director doesn't have to.
Yeah. And this entire movie, Burt Reynolds is playing, for all intents and purposes, Hal Needham.
He's definitely playing Hal Needham.
He is playing Sonny Hooper, the greatest stuntman alive. But let's talk a little bit about this cast in total.
Oh my God, this cast.
Because holy flirking schnit. We've got Burt Reynolds.
First of all, you want to talk about junky fucking movies. Let's talk about a junky fucking movie in which Burt fucking Reynolds plays stuntman to Adam fucking Batman West in what is ostensibly a Bond film.
Hey, Bert, old chum, if you wouldn't mind showing me how to do those tricks, I would greatly appreciate it.
Adam West playing James Bond with Burt Reynolds as his stuntman. That is what Hooper is.
That sentence, I don't mean to make you uncomfortable, gave me an erection. Big time.
You know what? You earned that erection. That is Hooper. That's the thing. Is this
Junk Food Cinema? You've earned that erection.
This is just the beginning, because what is then going to subsequently happen is there are going to be appearances by some of the greatest cinema stuntmen of the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
There's going to be people that you recognize. There's going to be Junk Food alums. And there's going to be one of the most beautiful women in the history of cinema. There's going to be cameos galore.
So many cameos.
It is nuts. So let's get into it.
So Burt Reynolds at the time was dating a woman by the name of Sally Field.
I've heard of her.
She is like...
Jenny.
She is... By the way, sidebar. The thing that I don't think ever really resonates with people about Forrest Gump is what a racist his mother is.
Oh, yes.
Like, they mention it, and I feel like it goes by the wayside because this is a testament to the awesome, like, how much you love Sally Field, that you ignore the fact that Tom Hanks tells you that he was named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who formed the Ku Klux Klan.
And that Sally Field fucked the principal to get Forrest into a proper school.
Yeah.
And you just kind of look the other way because it's Sally Field.
Because it's Sally Field. She's adorable.
She's the sweetest.
She's from planet adorable. Like, yes. She is so beautiful in this movie. And she is... Her first scene in this movie, Burt Reynolds rolls up in his truck and she comes out...
With two cans of Coors. By the way, Coors, important in the canon.
And down. In the cold brew canon. Yeah, and she just walks... As soon as he gets home, there she is. With two Coors, and I'm just like, hi.
And by the way, one of those beers for his horse.
It's very Toby Keith. It's a beer for his horse, except that it doesn't make me want to kick somebody. Yeah, so she's amazing in this movie, playing Hooper's girlfriend. This movie also has an upstart stuntman played by
Jan Michael Vincent. And Jan Michael Vincent in Jan You All to Hell.
This January.
It's time to Michael down your Vincents.
One of my favorite gags from Rick and Morty.
Yes.
That like me and six other people, you included, were laughing at.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like most people are like, what the fuck is that?
This is from the era of Jan Michael Vincent before he would become Captain Airwolf.
And how, this is how alpha Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds are. Jan Michael Vincent shows up and he's kind of likable. And by all accounts, Jan Michael Vincent was not a likable person.
No, in fact, here's the crux of the movie is that, you mentioned that his girlfriend is played by Sally Field. Who is Sally Field's dad?
A guy named Brian Keith.
Brian Keith.
Jocko Doyle.
So the whole mythos of this is that you've got Brian Keith. Brian Keith is the amalgam, is essentially an amalgam of characters, but chiefly that great stuntman that taught Hal Needham.
Which, according to the IMDb, I don't know if this is apocryphal, that stuntman is Sally Field's father-in-law. So there's a familial connection there as well.
Which makes a lot of sense. So then you've got the daughter of that stuntman.
I'm sorry, stepfather, not father-in-law.
You've got Burt Reynolds playing Hal Needham, who is not playing... He's playing the world's greatest stuntman, but the thing is he's the world's greatest stuntman at the end of his career.
Yeah.
Like, he is broken. He is Jackie Chan. He has broken so many bones that the doctor just laughs about it when he comes in. Like, there's actually a scene in which the doctor is laughing at the massive amount of damage. And like, Sonny... there's nothing I can tell you. You're going to jump one more time. If you land on your neck, you're going to be paralyzed from the waist down. Your ding dong too is not going to work. Yeah. And they're just laughing about it because it's like, you're not going to listen to a goddamn thing I say. And this is just funny.
The opening montage of this film is him getting dressed and you can see all of the scars, all of the burns. The only thing this movie is missing is a scene where they're comparing scars, where they're doing like the Jaws scene, but they're talking about the scars from different stunts because holy shit.
But so now people keep talking about this new kid in town, played by Jan Michael Vincent, who's a big fan of you, Sonny, and he's coming after you, and he's starting to break records.
Yeah.
And so Sonny instantly hates him. Instantly hates him.
Well, it's that changeover of the guard situation.
Well, but that's where I'm getting to is he hates him, and Brian Keith keeps going, yep, I remember that. I remember when you showed up and you were that kid. Mm-hmm. I remember hating you. So you're going to marry my daughter? And the thing is that what then happens is we get in a scene in which they're all at a bar together and they get in a bar fight with a SWAT team.
Okay.
Now we'll get into this scene for a moment. Well, because this scene requires its own conversation. But Jan Michael Vincent gets into a fight with them. And after that, they're good friends.
Everybody's
and he joins the team.
Yeah.
And from that point on, It's not competition anymore.
No, in fact, the headbutting doesn't come between Burt Reynolds and Jen Michael Vincent. It's between the stunt people and the director and the studio, which is so much more autobiographical, I feel. Like, there has to...
Oh, there's tons of stories here.
I want to know all the stories.
This is all of Hal Needham's stories put together, fictionalized into a movie. It's why this movie is truth.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. And I want to just take a quick trip on the sidebar here to talk about my love of Megaforce. A lot of people are like, dude, I get it. Like, it's a bad movie. It's campy. It's crappy. It's fun. Why do you love it so much? What I truly love about this movie is if you understand Hal Needham, you watch Hooper, and then watch Megaforce back to back.
I can't wait to watch Megaforce again now that I've seen Hooper.
And watch a bunch of stuntmen in the desert dressed up in science fiction gear making a kid's movie, because that's what it is. It is a movie by a director who has no right making a kid's movie. He and the stuntmen are doing all this amazing stunt work, making their version of G.I. Joe. And it is just off the rails, bonkers in everything they did wrong. And yet, every bit of stunt work in that movie is cool as fuck. And seeing Hal Needham in that battle van overseeing this 4-minute assault on a terrorist compound that, by the way, is done in real time with the clock ticking at the bottom. Like, this was Hal Needham going, let's go fucking nuts. And they go nuts. They jump motorcycles over tanks. They fucking do crazy shit. Yes, it's got a flying fucking motorcycle. It's got bonkers special effects. But the real special effects of that movie is the stuntmen, and you can see them, you can watch them have the time of their lives. And there is something pure about that movie that I genuinely, unironically love for that notion. And watching Hooper and understanding who these stuntmen were and who he was working with, and seeing those guys who are on that movie are in fucking Megaforce, because the stuntmen on that movie are stuntmen in all of Hal's work, because he worked with the same fucking team. And in fact, for those that haven't heard my previous episodes talk about it, Burt Reynolds was supposed to be Ace Hunter and turned it down. Hal Needham wrote that. And if you watch that movie thinking about Burt Reynolds instead of Barry Bostwick, that movie makes a lot more crazy sense. Like, a couple more camera looks. Like, you know, it's a very different movie, but dear God, that's what he was trying to make. And this movie shows you Hal's passion for the art of stunt, because it is a fucking art. Now, let's talk about the most meta scene of this fucking movie, when they are sitting around in a bar and they run into a couple of SWAT guys played by a football player and a couple of stuntmen.
Now, one of the stuntmen, the other, like the two main leaders of this, yep, SWAT that they get in a brawl with, is a guy we literally just mentioned a few weeks ago, who was also the big bad in Hard Times with Charles Bronson. And the other is...
By the way, go back and listen to our episode on Hard Times. If you've never seen Hard Times, holy fuck, Hard Times.
Hell yeah. By the way, it struck me again the other day that Walter Hill wrote the script for The Getaway, which I think is one of Peckinpah's very best movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I actually watched the remake recently with Alec Baldwin, Kim Basinger, that apparently also wrote the script for.
Well, I think they just used the same script.
I thought that too, but there's a huge... Okay, that's neither here nor there, but the point
WGA
is...
WGA regulations, yeah, another writer.
But there was nobody else credited on that script. That was the weird part.
Yeah, because it's hard to get your... You have to actually... In order to get your name on a script, if you're not the first writer of a script, you have to rewrite 50% of it.
Yeah. So, Terry Bradshaw, quarterback.
Famous quarterback.
Of the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 70s, when they were, in fact, the Steel Curtain. This is important because this is only Needham's second directorial effort. The first being Smokey and the fucking Bandit.
Yep.
That's a 1-2 punch if ever
I've seen. By the way, a joke about Needham in this movie is the character Robert Klein is playing this big action director based on Bogdanovich. But there's that moment where they go, when your last movie made $100 million, you can do whatever the fuck you want. That was actually a Needham joke, because his previous movie had made $100 million and he could do whatever the fuck he wanted. So he made Hooper.
True story. So they are in this bar and they're talking loud, and these two SWAT guys decide that they can't hear their music and they're pissed off that these stunt guys are talking loud, and they start shit. Now, one of the things I love the most about this movie is that because Burt Reynolds has so much of a comfort level with Needham, he is one of the most Burt Reynolds he's ever been in his entire career. Like, this is Burt Reynolds at 11, and he is just quipping and quapping all over the place.
He is so Burt Reynolds in this movie. The end of this movie includes a fourth wall camera look.
Yes,
it absolutely fourth wall breaking does. Camera look. He but, actually looks at the audience, gives the audience the okay sign,
yeah.
and then freeze frame.
Yes.
That's how Burt Reynolds this movie is.
True story. And this has one of my favorite Burt Reynolds gags of any movie I've seen him in, which is that they're like, we put 50 cents in songs in that jukebox. We can't hear him. You owe me 50 cents. And as soon as he stood up and asked for a helmet, I knew what he was going to do, but I'm still so glad he went through with it because it's so Burt Reynolds. He puts the helmet on, goes, okay, hold on, I'll get you 50 cents, and runs headlong into the jukebox, like a kamikaze Fonzie situation where he just crashes into the jukebox and then takes the money out. And this fight is about to begin. And this is the moment where I realized that J.J. Abrams has probably seen and liked this movie because Burt Reynolds looks around and starts counting. He's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12. 6 against 12. And then Jan Michael Vincent comes up and goes,
7.
7, which is such a great moment in and of itself. But then Burt Reynolds goes, okay, 7 against 12. Well, that's a little uneven. Looks like you guys will have to go back to Houston and get some more guys. And I'm like, that reminds me a lot of the Captain Kirk. There's four of us and one of you. We'll go get some more guys. And
I don't know that this is the first time it's happened, but it might be the scene he borrowed from.
Yeah.
The fact that it then turns into a bar fight.
Yeah.
But it turns into a classic Western
yes.
bar fight because the whole meta thing about this movie is it is a movie about stuntmen who then do all of their best stunts and do all of the classics. This is a greatest hits movie of the greatest stunts.
I dare say a hootenanny breaks out. A giant fucking hootenanny breaks
out. It is
out.
A Donnybrook, boy. It's a fucking Donnybrook.
And it's just bottles being broken over people's heads. And, oh, there's a great fucking gag. There's a great gag where Burt Reynolds gets thrown on a table where Sally Field is just trying to eat her barbecue.
Yeah,
and she picks up the plate and then puts it down on him. And he goes, how about give me a hand here. So she puts the plate down and, of course,
applauds. By the way, the only thing hotter than Sally Field in this movie is Sally Field playing a tough-as-nails fucking daughter of a stuntman dating Burt Reynolds' stuntman,
I thought you were going to say Field. The only thing hotter than Sally Field is Sally Field eating barbecue in a dive bar because
that
ticks a lot of my...
I sexually identify as...
that's my fetish.
That's, yeah.
Sally Field eating barbecue in a dive bar.
That is, yeah, you've just done it for me. That is... I'm done. I'm ready. You know,
and I love that this fight ends with all of them just spilling out into the street of the Palomino Club, which, by the way, I gotta get one of those shirts. The shirts that the staff at the Palomino Club wears are so fucking rad, and they just spill out into the streets, and the one guy who's Burt Reynolds' best friend, who actually was his best friend, acting coach for many, many years,
oh, yeah.
is like, well, we got thrown out of this bar, where should we go next?
Best part of that, though, is that once they get thrown out, by the way, they get the bar people... Because this is a stuntman bar, and that's the beauty of it. It is a stuntman bar. It's where all the stuntmen go. In order to get thrown out of the fight, they get thrown out through the window, and then the people that throw them out say, we'll see you next time.
Yes.
Like, that is literally how you get thrown out. Them and the SWAT guys start complimenting each other for being able to take hits in a fight, and they become instant best friends, and they're lying around in the trash fucking laughing their asses off.
And then they go back to Burt Reynolds' house and watch dailies of him in Deliverance spilling out of the canoe.
Well, it's his sizzle reel.
Yeah.
It's his reel of all his best gags, and they include some of his actual stunt work from Deliverance, which is really cool because they've got like this, so it's showing that clearly we're watching his stunt gags. And it's really good. By the way, this thing is riddled with character actors who will turn up in other Hal Needham films, particularly the Cannonball Run series, which ties into last week when we talked about Elam, who plays the doctor in the Cannonball Run series. See, this all ties together. Stuntmen, Jack Elam.
It's the Needhamverse. I mean, that's what we're building here.
And the Needhamverse is an amazing, amazing thing. And this film is so personal and it's so raw. And the thing is, the big crux of it is he knows he's done. Burt Reynolds knows he's at the end of his line. You know, his career isn't over. He's going to become a stunt coordinator. You know, he's a great stunt coordinator. He knows stunts. He knows how to do it. He knows how to come up with the gags. But there's this great scene where perfect fucking scene. Burt Reynolds, I swear to God, Burt Reynolds and Brian Keith had to be drunk during the scene. This is not acting. They are hammered. And they're going back and forth doing line. If not, it's just perfect fucking acting. But it is, they clearly appeared hammered. And they talk about, you know, I never said no to a gag. Mm-hmm. I never turned out, that's what I want on my tombstone. He never said no to a gag. And then they start talking about life. And what are you going to do? You know, are you going to marry my daughter or what? You know, and there's this great personal moment where Burt Reynolds says, you know, this career, stuntmen and wives just don't mix. And it goes on later on when he's talking to Jan Michael Vincent, when he talks about that, that, you know, for, you know, this idea that every stuntman loses his first wife. That was exactly what happened to Hal fucking Needham. Hal, there's a reason why Hal Needham lived in Burt Reynolds' pool house for 12 years. And it's not because he couldn't afford anything else. He was a fucking director who made huge movies. He was living with his best friend, and his best friend wasn't married, and his wife had thrown him out. And fuck it. They just lived together because it was awesome. And which is one of the greatest. You want to talk about greatest bromances of all time.
Which Bert, I do.
Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham are it. They are what you aspire to. You know, a lot of people talk about me and Scott Derrickson's bromance, and we are not a pimple on the ass of that fucking bromance. It is it is amazing what those two guys got into and the love they had for each other. But this movie is Hal Needham's autobiography.
Yeah.
It is the names are changed to protect the innocent and the fucking guilty. But it is very much what it was like to break yourself into nothing for Hollywood and never get the recognition except from the other people in the community, and that community loved each other. And it is, you feel that in this movie, and it's so great.
And I feel like that's the special place it hit for me, is that I am so obsessed with classic Hollywood, behind the scenes, Hollywood lore, and I just ravenously consume as much. I mean, it's the reason I'm such a big fan of the podcast, You Must Remember This, that Karina Longworth
does. Oh, yeah.
Which is just like, if you are into that as much as I am, it's like fucking porn. Like it's everything I love about all of the behind the scenes craziness, the stories behind the stories of Hollywood. And this movie is meta on that level. It's also intensely personal and frankly super fun, because because of the amount the relationship that Burt Reynolds has with Hal Needham, he is allowed to be the most Burt Reynolds ever. The stunt work in the movie, which is hilariously mostly outside of the movie that they're shooting, which I think is so much fun, that they're just getting into shenanigans that involves them doing stunt work that is outside of the movie that they're making. And then the central conflict of the movie arises when the director wants this huge fucking rocket car jump over a canyon that Burt Reynolds knows isn't safe, but basically is told, if you won't do it, we'll get the young kid. And he doesn't want the young kid not to do it because he doesn't want to be shown up. He's literally afraid it's going to kill this kid.
And everyone else in town turns it down. The thing is that Jan Michael Vincent comes up with it, and Burt Reynolds backs him up, and Burt Reynolds whips his dick out. Mm-hmm. He goes, yeah, we'll do it. What's your price for that? He goes, $100,000, $50,000 for me and $50,000 for the kid. This is $100,000. $1978.
So it's like $42 billion.
Like they were, like, this is a thing, like, they were, they're talking about making like 20 grand a year destroying their bodies. This is huge. He's like, this is pay off the ranch money. I want you to think about that. This is the money he's going to use to pay off his ranch and raise horses and be a stunt coordinator. And he's like, there's no way they're going to pay it. And they're like, I want it. We're doing it. But that leads to, holy shit, if you do this, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And it's like, but there's this thing of, hey, if we do that, what's the longest jump in history? 122 feet. How long is this? 325 feet. Well, shit. Who's going to beat us? Like, this is going to be in the record books forever. And we get to do this together. So it's not a competition. The beauty of it is, it's not a competition with Jan Michael Vincent in the end. It's all about two stuntmen making sure the other is safe, and they have that moment, and they have that moment where they're like, I'm calling off the stunt, and he's like, dude, at this point we can't.
Yeah.
Like, let's just fucking do it. Like, it's either gonna work or it's not. Let's find out.
And I think this is where the movie gets surprisingly and intensely personal, is that Burt Reynolds' character goes through some real conflict of whether he should do this, whether if he doesn't do it, what does that say about him and his entire life and his career? And it causes friction between him and Sally Field, but you believe every moment of it. It doesn't feel like rom-com, you know, relationship MacGuffin.
She's going to leave him. And yeah, and it's not that. It's not a MacGuffin at all. She's leaving. She can't. Her dad has just had a stroke. She can't watch the love of her life kill himself.
Yeah.
Like, it's me or the stunt. And then he's like, I can't not do this. And
I can't not do this for, like, and that's the thing that I really appreciated.
She shows up.
Yeah.
But she's like, do you want to, no, I don't want him to know I'm here.
Well, yeah.
Let me see him after he's done.
Yeah.
Like, it's the, I'm here. I love him. I'm worried about him. But if he pulls this off, then I'll yell at him.
But he also knows that the stunt can't be done with one person.
Right.
So it's not just an ego thing.
You need one person to do the jump and one person to watch the pressure on the rocket attached to the end of the fucking car.
Because there's a rocket attached to the end of the fucking car.
The third act of this movie is about Jan Michael Vincent and Burt Reynolds in a rocket car jumping a bridge that has just been actually blown up with dynamite. I want you to think about that for a second. That is the actual third act of this fucking movie.
I feel like when I say rocket car, some of you are thinking I just mean a really fast car.
No.
It's in fact a car with a goddamn rocket attached to it that's activated by a button. Essentially, a fuel-injected bomb on wheels.
Which they use again as a gag in Cannonball Run.
Yes.
The Japanese entry to the Cannonball Run has a rocket in the back.
Yeah, so that's clearly a risk. So it's not just this ego that prompts him to want to do this stunt. He's trying to protect, which, again, shows you how far along those characters have come from him being a threat to him being somebody that he feels a certain amount of responsibility for and somebody he needs to protect. And it's just, it's fascinating.
By the way, sidebar.
Which I feel like we never left, but here we are again.
We're in the sidebar. No, I want to go back to Cannonball Run for a second. Because again, this movie, the Hooper contextualizes everything. The reason why we love Hal Needham so much on this show is because of Hooper. And it melted my brain. I didn't realize until recently that you hadn't seen Hooper and you didn't understand to this level why these movies mean to me what they mean. Because there is a craft to these movies, even in the glitz and the goofiness of these weird ass fucking movies he made. You know, Smokey and the Bandit is great exploitation. Cannonball Run's weird. Cannonball Run 2 is even fucking, it's a fucking cartoon. He made some weird shit, but it was all having fun. What I wanted to point out was there was a big push to make Jackie Chan a thing in 1980. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that, and they know that's why he's in Cannonball Run. I offer a different premise. That was not why he was in Cannonball Run. He was in Cannonball Run because fucking Hal Needham recognized a real fucking stuntman when he saw one. And he's like, this guy's doing his own stunts. He's amazing. I'm amazed by him. I gotta put him in a movie. I gotta do gags with this guy.
And, I mean, it definitely didn't hurt that Golden Harvest co-produced the movie.
Well, yes, but... Yeah.
But that's probably why...
How that maybe happened?
Yeah.
Like, is that part of what... But I'm... Let us just enjoy for a moment that one of the greatest stuntmen in history directed one of the greatest stuntmen in history in a goofy, wonderful, delightful film that I'm still shocked we haven't covered.
Oh, it just... We will.
We'll get to Cannonball Run. We will never do two. I did an episode of another podcast where I talked about two... Two doesn't hold up.
As it turns out.
Two, as it turns out, is a mess of a movie entirely lacking a plot.
Which is funny because in this film, they're clearly making a James Bond film and then Roger Moore is in Cannonball Run.
Yes.
Also...
Oh, they use the James Bond theme in here and then change like two notes so they can get away with it. Bum ba dum bum ba da da bum ba dum bum ba da da.
Ours goes dun 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 dun.
And his goes dun 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 dun.
Yeah, it's a Vanilla Ice situation. But I wanna know this as a James Bond fan. What fucking James Bond movie are they making? Because there are two scenes where you're like, okay, I can see how that would be a stunt in a James Bond film. And then there's a scene with monks standing outside of a church setting a street on fire. And I'm like, This just turned into The Devil's Reign? What? How is this the same movie as the James Bond film? And then the whole ending is an earthquake that much, you know, we talked about how 90s movies are about trying to run away from things you can't run away from. They are driving away from an earthquake in this movie as the climax, which is fucking awesome.
So you want to know which James Bond movie this is?
I want to know which James
Bond movie. It's called The Spy Who Laughed at Danger. Yeah. James Bond's The Spy Who Laughed at Danger.
Maybe I should have
rephrased. Starring Adam West as James Bond in the alternate universe where Burt Reynolds is a stuntman.
Shaken, not stirred, old chum.
Yeah, I guess I should have rephrased the question. I have never seen dark pagan horror elements in a James Bond film.
Yeah, but you have seen James Bond run across the head of alligators.
Yes, I have also seen a pigeon do a double take. Again, all Roger Moore films should be pointed out. Okay, anyway.
It's a view to a kill.
On the chart of best Bond songs and worst Bond movies, it maxes out on both.
On both.
Yeah. It's one of the rare examples of a terrible Bond movie with a great Bond song.
Yes, but most of the great modern Bond movies have terrible Bond songs.
I think, first of all, Sam Smith can go fuck himself because The Writing on the Wall is one of the worst Bond songs I've ever heard. And fucking, was it, not Coldplay, but, God damn it.
Oh, are you going to shit?
Radiohead. Oh. Radiohead did a song called Spectre that was awesome and got rejected.
Yes.
And I'm like, and you went with that instead?
But we did get Cornell's version out of it.
Yes, I love
Cornell's.
Dude,
yeah.
You Know My Name is one of the best Bond songs.
Yes, it is. I put that top five.
And if you don't agree, just shut up because you're wrong. I'm sorry. Like, it's one of the best.
If you had ever said Chris Cornell doing a Bond song and I would, it's going to be top five, I'd be like, get out of here. And it's like, oh shit, that's really good.
It's so fucking good.
Stargrove.
Back into the driver's seat. That's the part of this movie that I think is really what's going to hook a lot of people in, is that much like Road Warrior, the last 15, 20 minutes of this movie is one epic, huge action sequence.
Oh, and the thing is they really, that's what's so weird about this movie, is this is a meta film. It is meta. You are watching actors do stunts, but you are actually watching stuntmen do these stunts. Like, everything you see is a real stunt that gets done in this movie, and the actors are making it look so effortless that you're not as amazed at just how amazing all this shit is. And in that, he builds the myth of the 70s stuntman to such a peak that you're like, holy fuck. It's why you and I have such a passion for a film that so many other people discard. Two films, actually. The Maniac Cop movies.
Yes.
And if you go back and listen to those episodes, we're constantly talking about the stunts because the stunt work in those movies are amazing. It's like, how the fuck did they do that? Dear God. And one of the longest sustained burns in history. And oh my God, this shit is crazy. This is scary shit. People putting their lives on the line. This is pre-CG.
I love the idea of falling out of a third story window onto the top of a truck and then onto the ground and then getting shot by Robert Davi. Like, you put a hat on a hat on a hat and set the hats on fire.
Yeah.
And love it.
That's fucking Maniac Cop movies. And that's and that's this. And you get this crazy sequence where they're demolishing buildings. There is a scene where a car is racing a demolishing chimney.
Yeah.
Bricks are coming down. A smokestack. Bricks are pouring down. And they got to beat it. And this is stuntman after stuntman actually risking their lives to make a movie about stuntmen risking their lives. And they also throw in all the fun things that stuntmen do that are the best. And it's really super fun.
And you know what? During that smokestack sequence, I did the thing that I do when I get really nervous that I have no explanation for, where it's like it's coming down and I keep waiting for the car to go under and I'm waiting and I'm waiting. So I do the thing I do when I get really nervous and I can't explain it. I just start going, guys, guys. Guys, I'm like yelling at the TV as if they can hear me in the 70s through my TV. But I'm just like, I'm barely conscious of it. I'm like, guys, 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 guys.
Somewhere in 1977, J. Michael Winston is going, what is this fucking sound?
God?
Like some guy, God keeps yelling at me going, guys, guys, guys.
Turns out it was just the time machine we keep talking about.
Guys.
That is the kind of deity I would be. Let's be fair.
Yeah, you're a fair god, but one that just wants to, people to be safe.
That's true. I want people to be safe, and I want that beer to get from Atlanta to Texarkana. That's all I really want. That's all I really want. Yeah. This is I again, because of how personal it is, because of how meta it is. On top of that, hilarious. On top of that, charming. On top of that, has some really effective, deeply personal moments that work on a dramatic level. And it's just awesome to watch. The stunt work, the jokes, like everything works. There's a great sequence where Burt Reynolds is taking Jan Michael Vincent around set and just whipping the car through other productions. And everyone's like, oh, hey, Sonny.
It's not Jan Michael Vincent. It's the awful...
Oh, you're right. It's the popcorn fart.
Yeah, it's popcorn fart.
Which, by the way, is going to become my term for big studio blockbusters that suck. So like Wrath of the Titans is a popcorn fart. Percy Jackson in the Sea of Monsters is a popcorn fart. That's going to be a new term for movies that look like blockbusters, smell like blockbusters, but actually
are directed
suck.
By really talented directors and still really awful.
Hey, really talented people can make popcorn farts.
I know.
Put that on a fucking t-shirt. But you know what? I am so upset with myself that we didn't cover this either during Summer of 78 or October, but I am happy that we finally got around to cover Hooper because
I'm glad you finally got around to seeing it.
I love it.
I got to see this on 35 millimeter a couple years ago. There's a great 35 millimeter print around and it's fucking gorgeous. And it's, in fact, I have a special place in my heart because the first time I watched this, I rented it on Laserdisc.
Laserdisc.
Not the Laserdisc you're thinking of. The original Laserdisc.
The CED ones? Is that what they were called?
The ones that you inserted the box and then pulled out the box and left it in there. I rented Hooper because it was one of the big Laserdisc rentals along with Time Bandits and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like that was my rental for a weekend. I watched those three movies together when I was 6 years old in 1981.
By the way, thanks a lot, Drew McQueenie, because now I can't not hear it when people refer to it as Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It's not. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It's never been that, but now when people say that, I would have given them a pass.
No, it became that 10 years ago when they released the box sets so they could all sit together on video store shelves.
No.
It became Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's what they titled the Blu-ray release or the box set DVD release. And yeah, no, I concur. It is Raiders of the Lost Ark. It is not Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's why I corrected myself when it started coming. I was like,
and you know what? Go ask Film Twitter. Guys, that brings us to the junk food pairing. And I mean,
if there's anything other than Coors, I'm going to smack you across. I'm going to actually hit you this time. 182 times, he never hit me.
I'm going to actually hit you this time. Yeah, it's definitely Coors. Coors has to be a part of it. I think a nice plate of barbecue a la Sally Field in that scene that has now become my fetish.
By the way, you know, we didn't do this tonight. We should have, but next time you're over, I have a new neighborhood barbecue joint that's pretty killer.
Oh, boy.
Right around the corner. It's 4 minutes away, and it's good barbecue.
Looks like we're going to be eating some barbecue. And you guys, seriously, the Blu-ray is about $12, maybe $14 on Amazon.
Dude, do it. You owe it to yourself. It's not a roll of the dice. It's a great movie.
I agree.
It is just a great film. There's nothing junky about it. You need to make no apologies for Hooper. Hooper is a perfect film. It is just a great film that does everything it means to do. It's very smart about what it's doing. The craft of it is there. It is hands down. As much as I love Smoking the Bandit, Hooper is Hal Needham's best film.
Yeah.
Like, it is his best film. It is his masterpiece. It is his love letter to his career. It is, if you watch no other film of Hal Needham's, Hooper is the one to watch.
Yeah. No, and if you listen really carefully, you'll hear the sound of me not arguing with that, because that is correct. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm, MassaWyrm. You can find my new podcast with Dave Chen, all about writing at writealongpodcast.com.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bry Guy Salisbury and of course at Junk Food Cinema, which you can also follow on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show.
I mean, you really like the show.
If you like the show more than Burt Reynolds likes to drive fast and drink Coors, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, where for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. I am so thrilled we got to cover this movie. Highest of recommends. And I'm going to end the show on a piece of advice that came from a bartender or a piano player in this movie that I think sums up a lot of our core values here at Junk Food Cinema, which is, all right, everyone get drunk and be somebody.